What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of books that have come out this week. So why don't we kick it off with a literally and figuratively big one, Absolute Batman 2025 Annual Number 1 from DC Comics, written by Daniel Warren Johnson, James Harren, and Meredith McLaren, with art by Daniel Warren Johnson, James Harren, and Meredith McLaren. So normally you got Scott Snyder and usually Nick Jagoda on these. We've had a couple of fill-in artists, but this is for the first time some new folks taking on the Absolute version of Batman. These are prequel stories that pit Absolute Batman against racists, show how he got his enormous Batmobile, which was a big question a lot of people had in the first arc of the series. And then we've got a backup story or backup stories showing some other aspects of this. Pete, you're our DWJ guy. What'd you think?
Yes. Yeah. First off, I just want to say stack is one of my favorite stacks ever. I really love this collection of comic books. I got to say, Alex, you did a great job curating this stack. I was really impressed with
all these books. I can't wait till we get to the Age of Revelation block.
Yeah, I was really impressed with Marvel this week.
I appreciate it.
All right, but yeah, so let's talk about this epic thing in front of us. Daniel Warren Johnson, I mean, damn, the flying knee to the face that Batman does in this is just insane. There's epic panels after epic panels. This is just like, I call him beef. This Batman in this is just so beefed up. It's glorious.
I call him beef.
The Batmobile is a building on wheels. It's fucking insane. This is just so intense, so over the top in all the best ways. The dad flashback gets you in the feels. That's classic DWJ there. I mean, the art is super tight bananas. I mean, this is a epic annual, one for the ages. This is just such a blast.
I think on the DWJ tip, for those of you that like us have been feeling a little like we're missing the classic DWJ in the recent Transformers run, this is a return to form, I feel like, from the original stuff, your Murder Falcons and whatnot.
Shout outs to the Murder Falcons.
And I think even beyond that, DWJ is known for like the incredible emotionality in the characters. There's some of that in here for sure, like Pete was saying, but the way that he's able to translate it to visceral, bone-breaking kicks and shit, and this is crazy. Can tell DWJ is like, I don't probably punch racists in my real life, but I'm going to draw the shit out of these dudes getting wrecked. There's an elbow break in the early part of this book, and then every time Batman kicks someone, their face is like a wet balloon smashing underneath the fist and foot. Yeah. It's awesome. It's a fantastic story that you get to see. Batman is simultaneously like the badass we've come to know in the Scott Snyder run, but much more hard-edged, like in a youthful way. It's interesting to me. If this is in thinking about it in continuity, it feels like he's very raw here in a way that we haven't quite seen in the Snyder run and violent. And I wonder if this will be folded into the series as a whole, that Batman was just like a straight up ass kicker for a while when he was first getting started. And then the James Harren story afterward is equally visceral and has a little more like horrifying sort of slow walk through this attack that Batman happens to be present for. And this was just, and I also like the last bit, the Meredith McLaren bit. It was just a great, package.
It was a tight package.
I also really like this book. The art's great throughout. The stories are great throughout. I do have one thing I want to throw out there that was striking me while I was reading this book.
Wait, let it be. Hey, Pete, it might be another compliment.
No, I love candy.
There it is. See?
That was all I wanted to throw out there. Do you agree? Do you also love candy, Pete? That's what I wanted to throw out there.
Yeah. I'm just willing to, I'm not willing to jump in somebody's van. No, what really were you going to say?
Oh, okay. What I was actually going to say is I do think, as much as I really like this across the board, I think there's a line here between the way Scott Snyder creates Absolute Batman and the tone of it And what the folks are doing here that I think is on the dial a little closer to Dark Knight Batman than Absolute Batman.
Agreed.
Sure.
Part of that is certainly that Daniel Warren Johnson is writing a Batman earlier in his continuity before he learned not to kill, which frankly is like one of my least favorite things in the entire world to read from a superhero, where he's like, I'm going to kill these people. And they're like, I don't know if you should. And he's like, oh, I haven't really
thought
about
that. In the murderer's tradition, you don't learn not to kill. Like, most murderers are like, I murdered and I'm going to keep on doing it.
So again, I really like this. That held me back a little bit. And also, just generally,
that was enough, man. That's enough.
What's enough?
It's enough of your, like, you know, negative
talking. I'm not slamming it. I've said several times that I like
this. You sound a lot like the racist that Batman bends their elbows back.
That's interesting. Perhaps we should. Oh, Pete does? Okay. I thought you were talking
about Pete. Yeah, that meant Pete.
Okay. I'll bend my elbow back just to be safe. Part of reviewing these books is talking about critically how they fit within the span of greater comics, and I think that's an interesting way of talking to them. But if you want to just be like, cool cover, let's move on, we can do that as well.
Great. Good.
Okay.
I'm glad we're on the same page.
We're not going to do that. Do you like candy, though?
I'm not going to keep falling for this.
It's not falling for it. It's a conversational gambit. All right. Why don't we move on, since Pete doesn't want to talk critically about this book. He doesn't feel like it's worth the time spending on it. We'll move on and talk about this instead. Imperial number 4 from Marvel, written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Federico Vincentini and Iben Coelho. This is the final issue of this series, which is redefining the Marvel cosmos. We are getting the final battles between all the various factions in space, setting up the new status quo for the galaxy.
Alex, wait, Pete, I know, sorry, I don't want to interrupt. I don't want to interrupt your recap, Alex, but just keep going and talk about sort of the setup and how we get into the story here. Just get into like the politics of the Kree and the Skrulls, because I just want to make sure everyone knows.
I would be happy to do happening. That. For sure. So what happened is that Maximus the Bad made a deal with the Games Master to create a delicate gambit that framed the Wakandan intergalactic empire for killing various scions of the various empires, leading to a galactic battle that ultimately was discovered first by what's her name, Darkhawk, and
let me
Gamora,
say you're actually doing way better at this than I thought.
Thank you. I do actually know the plot of this, but at the same
that
time,
that all happened last issue. What happened this issue made less sense than what you said.
Well, this issue is an epic battle that is a ton of fun. Also, why we're right here, cool cover. But yeah, this is a ton of action packed into this ish.
Wow, Pete, what's happening to you?
Are you being paid?
Yeah, this is weird. Because this issue, like, I was poking Alex to do it, but, like, this issue is mostly a fight between.
Yeah.
Like, we set up a lot of characters. You know, we got Shuri, we've got Black Panther, we've got Star-Lord, we've got the Inhumans, we've got a lot of characters that we like in space, Darkhawk. And instead, this is a fight between a couple random Kree and a Skrull who was undercover as a Kree and is maybe a scion, as Alex said, or like secret prophet that is now going to. The Skrulls have been sidelined from the intergalactic union that is formed in this comic. I was like, what the fuck? Where's the characters doing cool stuff in this? And honestly. Where it ends, we get the characters in interesting places a little bit. You have Star-Lord, who's, like, running shit. Weird. I love the way Nova is, like, mad in this. The Skrulls being sidelined and maybe becoming more villainous is sort of cool. Inhumans being sneaky. Black Bolt being, like, a sort of more of a court, like, influencing the court intrigue, I think is the right term, and sidelining Maximus. All that stuff was interesting, but this event in general I thought was just sprawling, weird, and it was like reading the news when it could have easily been way more fun than this.
But this issue I thought was a really fun battle sequence that was, I thought, what an issue. The whole thing was a fight at every page.
Yeah, but there was no stakes because he didn't know, like, these are people we don't know. And, like, he got sort of super
Skrull
powers.
You don't know
powers.
Who a Skrull is? You don't.
I know a Skrull. I don't know this individual.
Yeah, but.
You Peter tell me Quill, the outcome of this Kree Skrull fight. You're like, I hope the Kree win.
Yeah, I'm rooting for Klurt.
I'm just saying, I've read a lot of comics in my day, and I thought they did a fun job of kind of like giving us a ton of action with all the other stuff going on. So
hashtag justice for Klurt.
I do think there's some interesting places this ends up. I like where this ends up with Star-Lord. I do think, I don't know. I was trying to think about this in the span of the stuff Jonathan Hickman has done where he's like, I'm redefining blank, right? And the closest comp here is what he did with the Ultimate Universe, which started with, I'm really forgetting, it was not Ultimate Invasion, whatever it was, the miniseries that locked the Maker away for 2 years, which I think also was like a lot of stuff going on a lot of the time, but then led to the Ultimate Universe, which has been pretty great overall. Very cool. So I do feel like if this very messy miniseries leads to some great cosmic stories, cool. But indeed, as a book, this is way messier, more convoluted, and inscrutable than Ultimate whatever it was ever was. It is hard to tell, like you're saying, Justin, who we were supposed to follow here, who we were supposed to care about. And there are certain things like, I should have put a spoiler warning with the first one, but spoiler warning going forward here. The thing at the end with the Hulk, where he sees She-Hulk's message being like, hey, you're 2 days late, where are you? We know there's a Planet She-Hulk series where she's going to continue to be on Sakaar, and Hulk, nothing that is going on in this series makes any sense with Hulk's current continuity. Yes. And he has this smile on his face like, I'm going to fucking leave you on Sakaar, you dumb bitch. And I'm going on here? What
I fully agree. I was just like, I wanted him to be somehow pulled away from that so that there's a reason why She-Hulk is stuck there, because that series is super interesting to me. And I think what you're saying, Alex, it makes me think in general. Right now, especially compared to DC, Marvel editorial looks like messy. Just like between Imperial, One World Under Doom, and the Age of Revelation event, it's like everything's in just a different pocket. Nothing's speaking to each other. I just don't know what the overall plan looks like. And that's fine usually, but compared to the DC universe, that is like tight as a drum with the way it's running. All these series, very complicated continuity, and everything feels like it's feeding into the next thing, as opposed to this, which feels like, oh, right, Klurt.
That's a good note to leave it on. Disney Villains Maleficent, number one from Dynamite, written by Polina Gadasho, art by Theo Stultz. We actually talked to Polina Gadasho on our podcast. You can check it out in the feed about this very book. But this is not a continuation of the Sue Lee series that we loved so much. Absolutely gorgeous. This takes place during a little pocket of the movie, if I recall her talking about it correctly, and giving us a new adventure for Maleficent to go on. Pete, I know you're a big fan of this one, so take it away, and then Justin and I will shoot you down as we usually do.
Oh, great. Yes. That sounds like stack a real
king.
Fun.
Yeah. Let the Stack King shine.
Yeah, by the way, you were feeling good at the beginning of the Stack
King. I was, and thank you for beating that out of me. We don't want anybody having
some
joy.
No, I like this book. I like this book. This is a good book.
Amazing art. I know we kind of talked about the last book, but I also really love the art here. I feel like they did such a good job of kind of like turning up her mischievous kind of like grin and gave her some like really epic panels, kind of really showcasing her villainous side. I like this, her going on kind of adventures, her thirst for power. This is very intriguing and cool. I'm glad that we're getting these kind of books dealing with this Disney villains. I think this is, they're doing such a great job with this, and we've been super impressed with it. So they're really killing it, and this is a perfect example of that.
I think the previous book we really loved because of the storybook nature of it and the way it sort of departed from so much that happened in the movies. This book feels like it's both from the writing and the artist point of view, it feels like it's ripped right from the movie, a movie that I really like. And when we talked to Polina, like the way that she talked about the dark tinge on all of the early Disney movies, this book really reflects that. I like the way Maleficent is set up as a pure villain. She says multiple times, power. I love power. I just want some power.
Yeah.
And that's what she's chasing here. And that's what you get from the movie, too. She's just like mean for almost no reason. She's so casual. Like she's just getting invited to a birthday party, essentially. And she's like so mad she curses the child to die. And that's the kind of reckless villain that we get to see book.
You know, that's those high stakes of those birthday invitations. You know what I mean? Like, you can't, you know, one wrong move and you're cursing a child. You know what I mean?
And here's the thing. I don't know that because I didn't write thank you notes from my grandparents' graduation present. And she literally said, you're done. And I only saw her a couple more times before she died. So she's my Maleficent.
Wow, hard. That really took a turn at the end there. That was
Right, thank you notes is the takeaway.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Batman, The Long Halloween, The Last Halloween, number 10 from DC Comics, written by Jeff Loeb, art by Mateo Scalera. Got to write a goodbye note to this one because it is leaving with this issue. Wraps up not just this series, but it's supposed to wrap up the whole cycle of The Long Halloween, Dark Victory, Catwoman When in Rome, as well as this book. I know we've been kind of mixed on this, to put it lightly. What'd you guys think about this?
Well I'm actually curious, Alex, what you think of this. I'm going to turn the tables on you here.
I thought Mateo Scalera's art was a really nice match for Tim Sale. That's something that I think is important with this book because everybody's paying tribute there. I will give a shout out to Pete and I talked to Cliff Chiang at Baltimore about his work on this book. And it was really interesting hearing him talk about it, about how he was both like thinking about Tim Sale and then trying not to think about Tim Sale so he could do his own thing and getting that mix there. So do listen to that interview. But I think Mateo Scalera really nailed that here in terms of the look. There's some really nice panel layouts throughout this issue.
And that's sort of one half of what we got here. That's the art.
Sure. One half of the two-face, if you will. And I don't understand why we did this story necessarily. I don't think it adds anything on to the previous ones. But I do think there are some solid moments in here wrapping things up, even though I'm wobbly on how we got there.
Well, and that's why I was
sort of wanting to if I could just counter that point.
Well, let me back Alex briefly, and then you can counter, and then I don't know, go to bed or whatever.
Okay,
like,
good.
I agree with you. Like, there are great moments in this, especially with Two-Face. I think Jeff Loeb seems to have a really understanding and love of Two-Face, and that's what we're getting here mostly. To me, it's just like the beauty of the earlier Halloween stories is the twists and the way that like it felt like this mystery that Batman had to solve and was failing and then unraveled at the end. This one felt simultaneously like no one knew it was happening, and at the end it was like sort of the most obvious people were responsible. So I was like, oh, it was doubly disappointing when I feel like, and that's why it felt like maybe the whole project is a little bit caught up in the loss of Tim Sale and sort of paying homage to something from the past rather than telling a story that really does push it into a new direction. So like that's why I think, like you're saying, Alex, the art is really great, and that is the thing to celebrate in this book. Sorry, Pete.
Okay, great. Let me come back to life here. Yeah,
Undertaker. Undertaker meme.
Yeah, I just
and thank you for being so respectful of our opinions, Pete. I appreciate it.
Oh, always. Always. I mean, that's the nice thing about doing this show with each other. You know what I mean?
Yes.
The respect that we have for each other is real. So I think that, first off, amazing Tim Sale cover. You know, I mean, just an epic kind of nod. And I do agree that the art is amazing. And I think the nostalgia factor is nice for this. And the cat and bat moment that we got in this, Justin, I'm surprised you're not talking about it. But it's nice.
It's
quality stuff. Not the ship that I'm rooting for, but I still can appreciate it because it is done so well. And
what ship are you rooting for?
I like Batman and Zatanna. I like Batman and Wonder Woman. You know, I got ships. Don't worry about it.
Those are much harder to satisfy, I would argue.
Well, hey, you know, so you gotta.
You're a long shot ship.
Always. But I just think that this story landed well. You know what I mean? They wrapped it up good. There was twists and turns. It felt like we were honoring the thing before. And it's nice to see this. It's nice to have this in our lives again. So I was very happy with what they did here. And it also makes me want to go back and read the original. So I felt like they did a great job.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Death of the Silver Surfer, number 5 from Marvel, written by Greg Pak, art by Sumeet Kumar and Tiago Palma. This is the final issue of this series, which, per the title, seemingly kills off the Silver Surfer, as well as giving us a new Silver Surfer, an even crankier one, if you can believe that.
Oh, man.
Kelly Ko, who has been set up over the course of this series. You know what? I liked this. I don't know why I said that like that.
But yeah, why?
I think because, like, this felt like, on the surface, and I don't know, we have not talked to Greg specifically about this, but on the surface, this feels like the sort of thing, like, yeah, there's a female Silver Surfer in the movie. Why don't you do that? You know, like, that is what feels like maybe the impetus behind this. But Greg Pak, as usual, puts in the work and the effort to make it an interesting character who has a very different outlook than Norrin Radd and is interesting in her own right, and I'm excited to follow her going forward.
And maybe are such buddy buddies with Greg Pak, maybe you should talk to him about it. You know what I mean? While you're
jealous of our time with unpocking the Pak.
That's right.
He did say something about, like, wow, I love both the guys on your podcast, which was weird.
That's hard to tell who he meant.
Yeah, maybe, I know. Maybe that's all he said. We didn't ask him to clarify because
we did not follow up. But he did say he was like the death of Pete. I mean, the Silver Surfer. He had a weird slip, you know, Freudian slip.
Wow.
Yeah. Tim Seeley was standing next to him, and he's like, who's
Pete? Don't you dare. How dare you? How dare you?
It was crazy. Yeah. And then Daniel Warren Johnson was like, I'll write the death of Pete. And we were like, no one wants the death of Pete. And he said he would write it. I don't know.
Yeah, and then Lobo walked up and said, I'm Space Wolverine.
Wow. Sounds like a real moment. Sorry. Yeah.
And then you woke up from a nightmare, Pete, but we woke up from a pleasant dream.
Wow.
Our greatest
dream. Did you want to talk about this book or should I?
I did. Okay. Because, like you're saying, Alex, I was sort of bristling against the idea of this new Silver Surfer at first, but man, did Greg Pak really land it with this issue. I wish this had come out closer to the movie that introduced the female Silver Surfer, mm-hmm. because we don't know anything about that character in the movie, really.
That's true.
And she's much more of a Norrin Radd replacement, essentially. Well, this is a really interesting story, and this character learns a lot from Norrin Radd, and, you know, it seems like it's sad to lose him. A character that we haven't got a lot of great stories about in the main continuity, but this was set up really well. It incorporated characters from the rest of the Marvel Universe, Fantastic Four, Avengers, in a way that I thought was really well done. It didn't feel like fan service-y cameos. They felt purposeful for being there, and there were a couple great jokes in the middle there that I thought were really well done. So just it's rare to land the plane this well, and that's what Greg Pak does.
Yeah, he is a great writer, and I agree with everything you said, Justin. I feel like this was tough. You know, you get the death of the Silver Surfer, and you're like, hey, I like Norrin Radd. You know, understood what his battle was about, but yeah, this is kind of an interesting story. The way it's told, it lands really well. Kind of twist at the end where you're like, what the fuck? So, great job, top to bottom. The art is glorious.
I hope she's able to become the Silver Surfer for a bit,
yeah,
and really be it and not ignored.
Return to Sleepy Hollow, number one from IDW, written by Casey Gilley, art by Savannah Meyer. We talked to Savannah Meyer at New York Comic Con for their first exclusive interview on their first book.
Yes.
So check that out. Give that a listen. It was really awesome talking to them at the con. But this is the official sequel to the Tim Burton film from 1999, following the further adventures of Ichabod Crane and the other characters who live in Sleepy Hollow as they investigate a new supernatural mystery. And I will say, before reading this book, I was a little concerned about the whole Johnny Depp of it all, him being an utter dirtbag, I guess is the best way of putting it. But given the art style, given the direction of the story.
Alex, sorry to interrupt you, but I don't know if the Johnny Depp trial, Amber Heard trial, is part of the Sleepy Hollow continuity.
Oh, really? Okay.
I don't know if it's directly related.
I mean, we'll find out. It's just the first issue.
I mean, I will say Johnny Depp was in character as both Ichabod Crane and Captain Jack Sparrow for a lot of the court case.
Yes. My point being, I don't want to watch any of his stuff. I don't want to interact with any of his stuff. Luckily, this doesn't look like him. It doesn't feel like him. The art style is absolutely gorgeous instead. And it's a great, fun, spooky, supernatural story that is perfect for Halloween.
Yeah, I agree. The art is fantastic. It really transports you back to this time in such a way. It has such a creepy tone to it. Just some really amazing panels here. I love the art. And, you know, this is something that I was like, all right, you know, we've seen Sleepy Hollow. We've seen this all before. But I was just super impressed. It felt very new. It felt very fresh. It was kind of cool to see this Ichabod Crane and this kind of version. So, yeah, I was really impressed at how blown away by I was and how transported I felt. The art and the writing is such a great combination here. This is such a solid first issue. I can't recommend it enough.
The art that Savannah does is so great. I think, Alex, you compared it to woodcuts in our interview, and it really is that. It feels so of the time, and it's working really well, even the way, like, emotions are presented. I won't spoil sort of what happens here, but this is definitely something to pick up if you just want a great horror story.
Yeah,
it's definitely you don't need to be a Casper Van Diem fan to be like reading this.
Who isn't though from Starship Troopers? Come on.
Oh yeah, Casper, what a great name and almost nothing else.
Superman Red and Blue 2025 special number one from DC Comics, written by Paul Dini, Michael Walsh, Dan Abnett, and Rainbow Rowell. Art by Mirka Andolfo, Michael Walsh, Caitlin Yarsky, and Sian Tormi. You know, this is kind of a riff on the black, white, or black, white, and red books that the publishers have been doing for a while. I think over at IDW, they did a TMNT black, white, and green, whatever. But this is mostly, at least for one of the stories, limited into red and blue per the colors of Superman. Just as a note, I don't know what else they're doing, but in January, they're definitely doing a Wonder Woman gold and black, I believe.
Ooh.
So it's a little thing, but I think it's pretty cool. And this book looks fantastic. Like, your mileage may vary in terms of some of the stories. Some, I think, were stronger than others, as usual with this anthology-type book. Michael Walsh's story, I thought, was absolutely phenomenal.
So good.
Yeah,
my fave as well. That's the second story.
And the Rainbow Rowell Sian Torby story, I thought, was also absolutely wonderful. Nothing against the other ones, just those were sort of the highlights. But, like, particularly, I'll point out with the Michael Walsh story, limiting it to the blue and the red makes it feel like a blueprint in a story where Superman is building himself up. And I just thought, as usual with Michael Walsh, it's such a smart, pointed choice. Great book. Great special.
Yeah.
It's good.
I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, first off, this is a sick Samnee cover here that we get, and it sets such a great tone for what's inside. This is worth it for the art alone. Alex was talking about the use of color here. It's really impressive. It has such a tone, such a feel. It's so part of the storytelling. It's really, really fucking good, and I loved the stories. I thought this was a tight package, really well done.
with a lot of these anthologies, especially with Superman, you get one of them is usually like a slice of life, and Superman being like, I'm so busy. But man, this Michael Walsh story, like, is able to bring so much emotionality to it, which I feel like we're often lacking. So that one really stood out to me. And like Alex said, the Rainbow Rowell story was excellent. I like the Dan Abnett, Caitlin Yarsky. I found it strange that the Paul Dini and Mirka Andolfo story led, because that was sort of the lightest, goofiest one. That felt like that should have been maybe a later one. I think it would have worked better if it was more of like a fun palate cleanser as opposed to the lead story. Because it's good, it just was in the wrong place, I think. But otherwise, I thought this was just a nice different sort of emotional punch card of Superman stories.
It's funny you brought that up, because I had that thought, but I also appreciated the fact that that first story let us know that this package of stories were going to be so different from what we're used to when it comes to Superman. So I agree, but I also think that like it was kind of smart to be like, hey, this is really going to be art forward and different.
Knock you off your block a little bit.
Yeah.
Get you out of your comfort zone.
Exactly.
Well, while you're out of your comfort zone, let us enter the Age of Revelation with our
Nothing comfortable here.
It's the Marvel block.
It's the Age of Revelation block. We're going to be talking about four titles again this week, four new ones in the Age of Revelation. On Deadpool, number one, X-Avengers, number one, Expatriate X-Men, number one, and Cloak or Dagger, number one. Now, we'll figure out. Let's have a little discussion at the end, I guess, about what we're going to do with the Age of Revelation going forward. But we are now fully in. We have all of the titles on the docket. We've read them all at this point, broadly speaking, without getting into them specifically. How are you feeling about Age of Revelation? This is our final check-in after the first full month of the event. Justin?
Well, not to say what I already said about Marvel. But
then say something different.
Well, but I think this specifically about this event, it's just a little messy. There's interesting ideas and interesting stories, but like everything is a little bit, you know, the peanut butter and chocolate are a little mixed throughout the peas are in the carrots sort of throughout this event. I wish the titles stood alone a little bit more. And my favorite ones do. Like, we'll talk about some here that I think do really stand alone and feel like they're carving out their own pocket. But a lot of them are like a little bit in each other's lanes, where it's like, we're heroes and some of us are mutants and we're on this side or this side and we're fighting and we're trying to get to St. Louis, a place I'm in currently, which feels topical.
Dude, we get it. You're in St. Louis, bro.
All these stories are about getting to St. Louis. I believe it. I was just a little weirded out when I was reading this on the plane going to St. Louis. I was like, hey gang, I'm already headed there. I'm going
St. Louis.
Why don't we meet there on Deadpool? But I'm just saying, like, there are so many titles in the event. I appreciate that there are a lot of titles. I just wish more of them felt like they were doing their own thing.
I was not having a good time until this week, and now I'm completely on this event and feel like this is fun. I feel like this week's comics really kind of put me in a different space, and then they did, I think, a good job of kind of narrowing the focus and what the kind of goal of the books are. And this kind of new batch of number ones and kind of new teams, I think, injected life into this thing that I was over. Didn't want it, but now I'm along for the ride and first guy in line, so I'm excited.
Interesting. Holy shit. Big turn. Excited to talk about the individual titles. Just to wrap it up here, I will say that I think the same as I have every week with this, which is there are some that I liked and there are some that I didn't like quite as much. My most dismissive take that occurred to me while reading this week's issues is this event is a really interesting experiment in generating some new skins for Marvel rivals, and that's basically kind of what's going on here.
Wow. So, that is cynical.
Dude, shots fired.
It is very cynical.
Shots fired, dude.
I think it gets to the essential thing we've been talking around of, like, I just don't know what the spine of this plot is, but I don't know. Why don't we talk about the...
Hold on, just one last thing on that. Even beyond the spine, because I feel like especially these titles are so far away from the spine that like they would never have like a touch point on it. I just wish these books across the line had a little bit more of like a philosophy tied to them. Mm-hmm. And some of them do, but I just want like a little more like gathering of the forces and just sort of like, this is a book about rebellion, or this is a book. A lot of them are just like, we're sort of have to do this one mission and then we'll have to go back to this shitty world. I'm like,
they all start in X number of years in the future.
Yes, I know, but let's talk to that, because I think Undeadpool does have a very specific premise, a specific storytelling style, and is like what Tim Seeley does best, like a horror movie in comic form.
Yes. Are we moving on to talk about this? Because Undeadpool number one is written by Tim Seeley, as you said, art by Carlos Magno. And as we've been kind of talking around, one of the things that happened in the past of the Age of Revelation is this X-bomb went off, killed a bunch of humans, turned some of them into just brainless monsters. Some mutants it killed, other mutants it gave other powers, some humans turned to mutants. So lots of mix-em-ups going on here.
But even that, I'm like, wait, what did it do? Like, yeah. it should do one thing.
I agree. It should have been very clear on what it did. But regardless, it led to Deadpool becoming a mindless zombie, which he has already been in Marvel Zombies, but whatever.
Yep. Well, but the difference here that I think is really smart is the narrator of Deadpool is still in the head. Yeah. He's literally along for the ride on his body being evil,
That's a fun he's thing to do sad. With Deadpool.
Definitely. He's vaguely sad, but sort of like, hey, I've been sort of a bad guy all the time, and now I just have to be bad casually. And I'm like, oh, this really matches an aesthetic here.
What I think worked about this one is that, like you're saying, it feels totally separate to the event, to the point where it could have not been an Age of Revelation title, and I wouldn't have blinked. It could have just been like, here's a miniseries called Undeadpool that is running, and that's pretty much it.
I thought this was great. I really thought Tim Seeley is killing this, because it's such a fun idea of, like, taking the kind of Merc with the mouth and even though he's a zombie, not kind of taking away those quips and that kind of fun humor, and kind of put it where he is with us along for the ride and kind of commenting on the madness that's going down. I thought that was a fun premise, well executed, hilarious, weird, action packed. Poor Swamp Thing Jr. or Kid Swamp Ass. I'm not sure which one, but great art.
Kid Swamp Ass.
Tight package.
I believe it was Kid Man Thing, which is funny.
And Kid Man Thing. And this went to the top of my pull list. I just thought that this was such a something that I was not expecting. And I thought it was, they did a good job of being like, check this out.
Great character reveal at the end as well.
Yep.
Next up, we got X-Vengers number one. This is written by Jason Liu, art by Sergio De Villa. This is following the remains of the Avengers team. It's a mix of Avengers and mutant characters, including Cannonball. Danny Moonstar is now sort of Captain America. She has a shield. Hawkeye has a bunch of arms. Shang-Chi is there. Vision is also a Technarch. And Ant-Man is weird. Black Widow is now like a water lady.
Hydro Man.
Yep.
But woman. Well, and it is a little weird, but I actually like this one as well. This feels like Avengers meets Doom Patrol in a good way. Like, everyone's a little broken.
Yeah.
Danny Moonstar is like trying to step up and be to take the shield, and like, the characters are just like a little busted up, and the art really matches the vibe of that. It feels a little bit like Toxic Avengers series going on over at Ahoy. I thought this also had enough of a philosophy that I'm on board with this one. This is one I would like to read more of.
Yeah, I agree. I was super impressed with this. Enjoyed the many arms or many hands Hawkeye. I thought that was a fun thing. And
well, on that, it's really funny because having more arms as an archer is actually not helpful. It's actually sort of annoying. And I thought that was a good metaphor for what's happening here.
Cool. I thought it was
Justin's offering up an opinion.
A hot take, Pete.
Yeah, I you know, I could see what he was saying, and I was like, oh, that's a cool, my thought was like, oh, he could shoot more arrows, so maybe he could be more effective. You know what I mean? But you were like, no, those arms get in the way. So I was like, I wasn't trying to crush your dreams. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
We have to test this theory in person.
Yeah. All right, great. Yeah, let's work on that. But I thought this was a fun mashup here, and I really enjoyed, you know, the new Cap kind of like status, and also the kind of confrontation. I thought that was cool and done well, and I thought it was interesting. And I was like, oh man, I would like to see more of that moving forward. So I liked that mashup.
There are elements of this one that I liked. I thought Danny Moonstar as Captain America was great. But again, I think this, for me, gets into one of the conflicts that the Avengers seem to be in an area that is pretty much fine. Like, there's nothing that's been wrecked about it. They go over to the Revelation territories, and they're pretty friendly with the Revelation people. And it, again, we don't have, like, a clear bad guy or a good guy. It just sort of is, you know? And there was a better understanding of how the world worked, because we're being thrust into it, not understanding a lot about it, I might like this better. But as is, that there is a fully operational and mostly fine Avengers team in the middle of everything else that's going on, versus them being like, we're fighting against Revelation, is, it's just scratching at the back of my brain is a little weird. That's all. Yes, Justin?
I was going to say, I think a larger story is going to crystallize. I bet it's going to happen as these individual series are wrapping up.
I don't think so. What I said at the beginning of this, that we had the Alpha issue essentially, and then we're gonna have 16 3-issue miniseries and then an Omega issue, I think that's where the story is. It's in those two issues on either side.
Oh man, I think something has to emerge.
I guess we'll see.
Wow.
Time will tell. Okay.
Time will tell. I would be more than happy to be wrong about this. Expatriate X-Men number 1 from Marvel, written by Eve L. Ewing. This is following a team of X-Men that are on a flotilla. They are a combination of Miss Marvel. You got a couple of folks from, oh my gosh, Eve L. Ewing's last title, Exceptional X-Men.
Exceptional.
And a couple of others. They are rescuing a mutant, but there's some betrayals going on, some twists and turns throughout. What'd you guys think about this one?
Yeah, I love this as well. I really thought that the, art was great. Interesting kind of team here, twists and turns, double crosses, you know, Mystique is involved. So, I mean, who can you trust there? Love the art, love the story. Cool team. I like the team on this as well. I thought it was an interesting collection of people. So I was kind of like, ooh, what's going to happen when these all get on the same page here?
I like the core idea of this, of a strike force with a betrayal at the core. This one is the most like lost in the sauce of the books this week, though, of like, oh, we're trying to get this mutant over here. We can travel back in time, do this. There's this happening. Oh, we have to get the mutant here. Like, it just felt a little all over the place, which is the symptom of the larger event, I think.
Oh, it's just when you said sauce, I was thinking of Sauce Monsters, and I was like, oh, no, I got to wait for that.
We're not there yet. We're not there yet. Hold on to it, Pete.
Wait for that.
You got to wait for that. Like Heinz coming out of the ketchup bottle, you got to wait for that. I really liked a lot of elements of this. There is a thing when they're saving the mutant and the mutant dies, and they're like, well, got to try again. And I believe the character's name is Rift, who essentially could move back to save points. Which I thought that was very cool. That was a fun sequence.
Yeah, that was
really
a cool sequence.
That would be a useful power in this post-apocalyptic world.
Oh, yes. Man, would it.
And like Pete was saying, I think Francesco Martorena, particularly with characters, is very good. Like, I really liked his Miss Marvel. I also thought the other characters were very clear. Some of the action and layouts were a little messy throughout this, though, which made it sometimes hard to follow. And like Justin was saying, in the latter half of the book, though, I am intrigued by a lot of this. It is tough to know who is betraying who when we don't actually know who these characters are or what they actually want yet.
There it is.
Yep. Great.
Pete's mad. He has to defend his X-Men.
Yes.
Yeah. To me, my X-Men books, Pete says. Like
Cloak
the Professor
or
X.
Dagger, number one, written by Justina Ireland, art by Lorenzo Tomita. In this issue, we find out that Cloak and Dagger have been hit by the X-Bomb and become one person so they can switch in and out. Meanwhile,
oh,
who are they fighting against? The Fenris twins, who are two of them. They are essentially one person who is two people, and we got two people who are one person.
What?
Twin
conflict. How can you keep track of this?
This has been this is my favorite book of the week in the Revelation, and one of my top picks for the whole event.
Wow! Come on!
This has been the most exciting, I think, Cloak and Dagger have been in a while. Like, this really advances their relationship in a way that I'm like, oh, please make this part of main continuity. The idea that they're in a relationship, they have the one of the time they have to pop out in the real world, and they have a kid in the, I guess, the shadow realm, the dark hold realm, whatever
inside
they're calling
the cape
it these days.
Dark
inside
force.
The cape. Dark force, that's the right term. I thought this was great. I like everything about this. So I hope I would read this as an ongoing.
I disagree a little bit with Justin, but I do love this. I disagree with the fact that, like,
interesting.
Your statement of like, oh, this is the best that we've seen of it, because, you know, like I came around on the TV show and really fell in love with that. I've also seen
pure comics, but I'm also like, aren't you sick of the Will They Won't They? Pete, have you ever seen a romantic comedy?
How dare you?
Pete, have you ever seen a romantic comedy?
Dare you say that to me, sir? Won't They is my whole life force, bro. Are you kidding me? I watched so much 90s sitcoms on the Will They. Like, maybe this is the time that Kevin really can do it. You know what I mean? Like, Wonder
so
Years.
So sorry. I'm legally required to let people know if your ears are bleeding right now because of how loud Pete shouted, we cannot pay you for that. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Please don't.
Did you
just
make
us
a Wonder Years Kevin Winnie reference?
Well, yeah. You want to talk about Will They, Won't They? Dude, I waited years for that.
Well, here's the bad news, Pete. Won't they? They're a won't they? While Cloak and, spoiler for Wonder Years. While Cloak and Dagger in this book, they're a will they. So why don't you get on board, my guy?
Well, I feel like they're a little bit more of a who they, because they're the same person.
Who that down in Nolan Saints. The ore is not something. I like both these characters, so the fact that we're kind of splitting our time, I'm
you don't
like,
have to choose. You don't have to choose.
The ore hurts a little bit. But I love this. I love these characters. This is great use of these characters. Tons of action in this. I thought this was kind of like, this creepy brother was interesting, and the sister and all that. I just thought very kind of cool, interesting. It felt like old school Cloak and Dagger, which is, you know, when you were saying.
It felt not like that. It felt like new Cloak and Dagger. Well, what was old about it?
It got me excited, like the olden days of when I was reading the comic, and I was like, oh, wow. So that's how I felt about it.
The olden days. I thought they could have done a little better job introducing the concept. Like, I got what it was pretty quickly and understood where they were going with it. But
it's right in the cover, Alex. It says
No, I got it. But I think they roll with it a little too much. They're like, yeah, you know, they're the same person. Anyway, moving on. When it seems like next issue, based on the teaser, they're going to be like, and now find out how Cloak and Dagger got this way. And I'm like, maybe that should have been the first issue. Aww. And this should have been the second issue. I don't know. Anyway, it's fine. I do like the concept.
How dare
and
you,
I thought the scene of Cloak visiting, who is, I believe, their son in the Dark Force, was great. So very happy with that. Supernatural number one from Dynamite, written by Greg Pak.
Daughter.
Daughter? Is it daughter?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Supernatural number one from Dynamite, written by Greg Pak, art by Eder Messias. This takes place during earlier seasons of Supernatural and follows the Winchester brothers on new adventures. This is a oversized issue, I gotta say, as they tangle with a new demonic entity and try to take it down that is causing what seems like spontaneous combustions. Pete, I don't know how much of a Supernatural and SPN fan you are.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I'm not a fan of Supernatural, but this really won me over. I really thought, great last panel. I'm very excited to read the next issue. They did such a great job of, like, pulling you in, getting you kind of up to speed. I thought tons of action, twists and turns. I thought this was a blast.
This is fun. I also didn't watch this series, so I don't know too much about the backstory here. But I think they do a great job of ushering us into this world and getting us caught up with the vibe of the characters. Greg Pak is like a journeyman, a yeoman when it comes to a writer that can pick up on a different series in different tones and really deliver with them. And I think he really does that here. Setting up these characters in the world and also dealing with one situation that is going to spin out into more difficult situations.
Yeah, I think one of the greatest things about Greg Pak is that when I'm reading Greg Pak, I don't know it's Greg Pak. You know what I mean?
Mm. I do know what you mean. As the person who did watch Supernatural, I guess, on the podcast, I do think he captures the voices of the characters quite well. It is funny after 15 seasons of the show, going back to the early beginnings of these characters and seeing them again from that perspective. But I do appreciate also this is essentially a done-in-one adventure, though it seems like we're going to have an overarching story as well, which is exactly what you want out of Supernatural. Yeah, fun stuff. If you like the series, I think you'll like this. Batman and Robin, year one, number 12 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid, art by Chris Samnee. This is the final issue of this series, going back to the origins of Batman and Robin, as they team up against Two-Face and Clayface and other people with faces.
Pete, so many faces.
I know you love the Sams. What'd you think?
Yeah.
Was Sams
yeah.
wise to do this?
Well, first off, Chris Samnee cover, sick, bro. Just, we've gotten two sick Samnee covers here. Yeah, I like this. The art sets kind of a lighter tone, which is really cool. You know, sometimes with Batman and Robin, it's so dark. This is fucking absolute and dark. This is nice. It's touching. It might be a little too touching at times, a little too cheesy maybe, but man.
Too touching?
I just thought there was like some really cool moments here. The kind of nod to the giant Penny in the Batcave, where like Robin's like, "Hey, giant
Penny for your thoughts."
Yeah, world's largest penny for your thoughts. Oh, that was great.
Well, while you're talking about lines, I want to shout out my favorite line. Robin talking to Batman, "You're the one who dressed me like a basket of bell peppers," leading to it. I was like, great observation. Really
fun
stuff.
Sick burn.
Sick burn. I want to see this as an ongoing, like, this is a great team. This is a great vibe. It's the kind of Batman and Robin story that I think would work so well right alongside some of the more dark and intense stories like Absolute Batman and all of that.
And I also think that, like, sometimes Batman's so dark you can't see his face and his expressions. And there's, like, moments where they're, like, wall climbing together that you can see Batman is proud of Robin. You know, like, there's really kind of touching moments when they, you know, call themselves the dynamic duo in here. It's just, it's rich. It's well done. It's very kind of, it's nice to see Batman kind of in this light as well.
Do you identify with Batman in that situation, Peter Robin?
It's tough to say. I mean, my age makes me want to say Batman, but my heart makes me want to say Robin. You know what I mean?
So, but are you like, I want daddy or I am daddy?
Whoa. I don't agree with any of that sentence.
But do you want daddy or are you daddy?
Are you daddy?
I guess so.
Pete, are you daddy?
Oh, Daddy Pete, Runaways, number 5 from Marvel, written by Rainbow Rowell, art by Elena Casagrande. Excuse me, this is the last issue of this One World Under Doom tie-in as the Runaways team all joins together to fight back against an army of Doombots who are there for Doombot to bring him back, leading to a kind of new status quo for some of the team. What'd you think about this wrap-up here?
Well, first off, this was great. I really love this kind of group here. I thought this was such a fun arc and cool. You know, like Doombot grows a heart and realizes, like, hey, I'm following a horrible leader who's doing horrible things to people. Why have I, you know, given so much of my life to this guy? So that was a cool moment. But also just the team, and like when Doombot comes back, it's like, oh, Doombot. You know, like I just thought this was cool, and they're going to pick out a name for him. So I'm sad that this title is ending because I really love this, and I thought they did such a great show. Also, this cover is fucking fantastic. Gets you excited for what's on the inside. Yeah, this is a tight fucking package, and I had a fucking blast with this issue. This is a fucking great issue.
Right. Holy shit, Pete's on a heater right now. I shouldn't have said that daddy stuff. Pete's feeling it now.
One way you become a daddy. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Pete, comments? Pete, a response? You take a time, think about it. I wish this was an ongoing. I was really bummed to have this ending here. Like, while this was technically focused around Doom, this is just a great Runaways miniseries that you can just pick up and read without being connected at all to this sort of wonky event. Great character moments for so many of the characters here. A little bit of new status quo across the board. We're going to get to see some of these characters going forward in the new Scarlet Witch series, but I just wish this was going to continue on. I love being around these characters.
This issue in particular, I think this was my favorite issue of the five of the miniseries. There's a moment that you were intimating towards, Justin, with Nico Minoru and Gert that happens here that is just so much fun. I was just like, I had a smile on my face most of the time while I was reading this issue. It's absolutely delightful. Yes. Rainbow Rowell knows these characters like nobody else. And like you're saying, I do hope she gets to continue in some way. Sleep number 6 from Image Comics by Xander Cannon. This is about a guy who probably, we don't get to see it, probably
kind of
turns into
like
a horrific monster every time he falls asleep. He thinks he has found a way to stop it in this issue by burying himself in a mine deep below his town. But some terrible things are going on above the town, leading to a surprising end, and then even more surprising end, like a post-credit sequence, which was kind of a shocker. This is by far one of my absolute favorite books that is on the stands right now. It is gorgeous. It is stunning. I don't know where the story is going to go issue to issue, but it's like absolutely nothing else that is coming out from comics.
I know that we have the power to simply type in how many issues this series is and will be. But I haven't done that, and I don't want to, because I love getting to the end of every issue and be like, I can't believe there's more. Every time they trick me, I feel like, oh, this is wrapping up. And it's not. It keeps going. And this did it twice, where I was like, ooh, great twist. And then we get a second twist at the end. I was like, how dare you slap me in the face twice?
Yeah, yeah? It's a double slap, that's for sure. This comic is a whole nother level. And it's interesting because, like, if you would explain this comic to me, I would have been like, fuck you, I don't want this. Because the fact that they withhold information the whole time, and it's still so artistic and so epic and so well done. I feel like I'm like every time I pick up this comic, I'm like, oh, they better tell me if he fucking's the monster or not. Like, I want to know if he's the goddamn monster. So the fact that I still don't know, yet I get excited every time I pick up this book. The use of red, the use of color,
the art is
just so excellent. Impressive. It's really next level. It is so cool, this art. I can't believe that I'm still enjoying myself. I would have thought if you had told me, like, oh, yeah, 16 issues in, you still don't know if he's the fucking monster, I'd be like, fuck that. No, but it's just, the writing is so good. They give you enough. They keep you coming back for more. You're so excited to read the next installment of this. This is really impressive comics.
What if in the last issue, the monster at the end of the story is you people?
Well, that's the thing. Like,
there's a mirror.
They gotta land the ending, because if it's not, and they've, you know, and oh man. So
what if it's Grover? He could be the monster at the end of the book.
It's about I that's who I suspect. Hey, you know, we've been fooled. We've been fooled about it before. Yeah.
Yes, I am a dad. You know why?
Because you read your kids' bedtime stories.
Fucking
no. Fuck yeah, that's daddy.
That
Pete, you, the fact Pete, that daddy. You got silent and then Pete, got close to the daddy. Microphone was
Pete, so your daddy.
It was yeah. No,
sploosh,
I did not.
Right, Pete? Sploosh.
Nope.
Pete is daddy.
Yeah.
Also, I don't want to apologize to anybody whose ears bled after that. You deserved it. And you loved it. You loved it. Crownsville, number one from Odie Press, written by Rodney Barnes, art by Elia Bonetti. This is a... God, I got to work past true crime because that's not what it is. But
that's the thing. After reading this book, I Googled. I did some Googling. And great. This is true. This place
yes.
is.
So, but yes. True crime is not the term. It is true supernatural stories or true weird stories, I guess is the way to put it. Something that Rodney Barnes, we had him on the podcast a while back. Talking about his podcast is something he's clearly very interested in. And now he's spun it out into this book that focuses on a maybe haunted psychiatric hospital that were
probably definitely haunted.
Sure.
It does feel haunted by the end of the issue.
Yes, exactly. But I'm saying in real life.
I'm saying in real life it's probably.
No, I know what you're saying. Haunted. I understand what everybody is saying. You're all being abundantly clear. I'm just trying to get through the sentence and the setup for the book. In this hospital where a bunch of kids maybe died because of horrible experiments that happened back in the day, and now we got an investigator who is, not an investigator, a guy who is working there, who is discovering some stuff that's going wrong. There's a lot of other folks that are involved around Crownsville. It is, to give you like a little bit of a comp, it's a little bit of like a Candyman type thing without the hook-wielding maniac, just in terms of dealing with real societal issues, particularly when it has to do with people of color through a supernatural lens. There's also a bit of like the Tuskegee experiments going on there with a very, very different focus. So that gives you a sense of the scope the book is looking at. It's not a big small, basically.
Yeah.
Well, And the progression of it is really nice. It moves like a podcast where you're learning different pieces of the story from different characters over the course of this first issue, building toward like these bigger reveals as it goes on. And it's very meticulously made in a great way, I think.
Yeah, it's scary for a lot of reasons. And one of them being, like, I looked up this place, and it is real, and a lot of horrible things happened to there. And so it's heartbreaking on a lot of levels. But this book is really impressive, super scary, and artistically amazing.
And we want to announce that we are doing our next live show from the Crownsville.
You couldn't pay me.
Yes,
you
check
couldn't
it out.
Pay me enough money. There is enough money
We're
in the world
it,
for
We're doing it, I
me
believe, Halloween
there.
Night at midnight. Is that correct, Pete?
Yeah. Nope. That's when the fans want it.
At the witching hour.
No way, man. We would all die. We would all die.
Well, we'll find out. At least we'll die doing what we love. Podcast.
Together.
Together.
And then we'll be tied together for the afterlife, infinity.
Oh, man. I'm
a podcast for no one.
The Mortal Thor, number three from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Pasquale Ferry. Bunch of stuff going on in this book. The main thing, it certainly seems like Thor is trapped in a human body called Sigurd Jarlsson, who just wants to be a construction worker. But boy, people won't leave him alone. Meanwhile, it was, we find out in this issue, beyond all the cool hammer fights, is there might be a little something more going on here that we don't expect. There's hints there that this idea that I presented at first, that like, oops, Thor is a human and he's lost his memory, may not actually be it. And we're going to find out in subsequent issues. What'd you guys think about this one?
Yeah, this is great. I've been really enjoying this run. I think it's really artistically cool. It's kind of fun to see Thor wielding his hammer as a human here. And then at the end, we get the information that, you know, well, Alex went out of his way not to spoil it, so I won't just blow past that and spoil it. But I enjoy what's happening, and I thought it was a very cool reveal and very exciting, so I can't wait to read the next issue. But as this cover indicates, the art is glorious.
I love the fidelity to the construction industry in this title, like in this issue especially. It's like, I'm looking for an iron worker. He gets his union paperwork signed via magic and then gets to become an iron worker on a high rise. I come from a background of construction workers, and it felt so real, except for the part where you tie a rope to your hammer and just wing it at people.
Well, that way you don't drop it, you know what I mean, when you're all the way up there. It just makes sense, man. Think
very
about
rare.
It.
Very rare. There's not very little hammering happening. Like, all this stuff, this talk where he's hammering these rivets into these I-beams, I'm like, I don't think so.
Well, he's strong enough, he can do it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but all the other guys are like, he's hammering them? That feels weird. He's wielding a goofy ancient hammer. But more seriously, this was maybe starting to crystallize for me, because thinking about Thor's past, he originally came to Earth because he was banished as sort of being taught a lesson. Mm-hmm. And we get some reveals later on in this issue that makes me feel like that may be what's also happening here. Ooh. And this is not about not an evil plot on Thor, but more of a like humanity, humbling of Thor after Thor has been so elevated in the last like decade of storytelling. That could be something that's happening here, and I think that's cool.
Well, what's weird is you said you came from a family of construction workers, but then you called the hammer weird. And if you really worked in construction, you would know that hammer and know that it isn't a weird hammer.
I know that hammer, but that's not a hammer people use to do anything. It's a hammer people have hanging on their wall when they're like, look at this old hammer I found.
Well, this takes place in a certain time period where that hammer makes
sense. The present day. You mean the present. What's your background? What's your family background, Pete?
We're mostly hammer makers.
Oh, well, isn't that convenient?
Feral, number 17 from Image Comics, written by Tony Fleece, art by Trish Forster and Tone Rodriguez.
Fleece!
The current arc of the book finds our cats hiding out in a gigantic pet store from the rabid cats who are outside. But the cliffhanger of the last issue was one of them opened the door. And now the rabid cats are getting inside, leading to anarchy inside of the pet store and some really cool scenes. I talked to Tony Fleece at Baltimore at length about this book. Please do go check that out, particularly about this arc and how this is the grossest arc so far, for sure. But as usual, they find a way to amp up the horror and then just keep it on going, pedal to the metal at the end.
The fluff is puffed, right, Pete?
Oh, man. I got to say, I also ran into Tony in Baltimore, and I had a quick conversation, not on tape, unfortunately.
Oh, off
but
the record. Okay.
Off the record.
Wow, interesting.
And it was funny because I was like, hey, man, I can't believe I'm still loving your book. And he was like, I can't either. I keep waiting for you to drop off, but you're still hanging in there. I'm so impressed. And I was like, oh, thanks, man. I think it's a lot to do with your writing. But, yeah, I feel like you're going to fuck me at the end. But
casual conversation. He's daddy.
By the way, that's not how off the record works, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. but yeah, he laughed. So it was a fun conversation where we were both shocked how much I'm enjoying his book.
Because you think you're going to be too scared.
Yes. I keep thinking this is going to be the issue where I walk away and be too scared. But the writing
and it wasn't this one?
That's the thing. I can't
Does
believe
it make
I'm still
you hungry?
Here.
Are you getting hungry?
Oh,
hungry
no.
Hungry for kitty?
Oh, no, stop. This is so gross.
Yum, I love kitty.
I laughed out loud, though, at the holy shit line when one of the cats is just like, holy shit. Yeah, this is an insane story. Like, it's really like, hey, you know that your childhood and all those amazing Disney movies that you saw and enjoyed as a kid? Well, do you want to have fucking nightmares for the rest of your life and be ruined? Welcome to Tony Fleeson's world. Like, this shit is... It really haunts you in such a way that is, and I dare you to watch fucking like Lady and the Tramp after this because you can't. It's just, it fucks everything up.
I while I read the comic book and then immediately every time I watch the entirety so of Lady twisted. And the Tramp, I eat a big plate of spaghetti and meatballs.
When the moon hits you like a big... Oh man!
All I need is somebody to suck that other end of the spaghetti.
Really beautiful.
Well, why don't you get mother two to daddies. Do it? You know what I mean?
I spend so much time.
Mother, your daddy up. Is issue.
Justin. Mother.
Am I mother? Pete.
I don't know.
Am I mommy?
Mother dies horribly in this issue.
I spent so much time setting up like little Italian restaurants in alleys in New York for cats and dogs to come kiss and eat in, and no one. I still can't get a lot of rats.
Yeah,
sure, but I don't want rats to kiss. But I want rats to pilot chefs in different restaurants that I own.
Once you get it, though, your Instagram is going to take off, bro. It's going to be sick.
Thank you, man. Thank you for backing my business plan.
Yeah.
This book is fantastic. It's the perfect synthesis of the Don Bluth animated style sweet feature film and the worst, nastiest episode of Walking Dead you could think of. The death in this issue is especially gruesome. There are a couple, but one in particular. And the way that these cats are in danger all the time, I'm worried about them.
I'm so worried. And they're not going to stay, are they? I mean, they got to get out of there.
Cats are hard to make stay, Pete. Have you ever had one? They do what they want.
Yes, I have.
That's a real cat lover's banger for Pete LePage right there. Got him.
Yep.
Godzilla versus America, Kansas City, from IDW, written by Buster Moody, Freddie Williams II, and Kyle Stram, art by Ludwig Olimbo, Freddie E. Williams II, Jake Smith, and Baltimore Rivas. This is the latest in a series of anthologies that not only are set in a specific city and have various stories about Godzilla, but I believe also come from creators from that specific city. So these are all probably folks from Kansas City writing about their hometown. Pete, take it away.
Yeah, this was so awesome. I also really love it felt like all the individual stories kind of built on each other, which I thought was really smart. I think they collectively also told a bigger story, which was so cool.
Death the last two.
Yeah, and I think that this was such a great use of an idea and so well executed. It was fun to see Godzilla in Kansas City. It was fun to see all these specific Kansas City things and hilarious the sauce monster idea and all this stuff. I was having a blast. I also love the first story with the graffiti kids. I just think this is just a fun use of Godzilla and a fun kind of exercise of hey, let's have Godzilla go to Kansas City. What happens? And I think this is artistically great and just such a fun, well-executed idea.
Especially the last two stories that work together felt like they were using Kansas City as an idea that I could get on board with. The first half of the book is very much, I was like, am I at a party I wasn't invited to? There's so much of the book is shouting out Kansas City things. I was who's this book? I was like, this feels like this book should be released locally. It's like Godzilla versus the LePage family. It's like, yeah, I bet the LePage family is going to love it because it's going to be all their specific references. But it felt just very, very strange. Felt like being in a comedy show in Kansas City and being like, I don't quite know what anyone's talking about. But the last two stories I thought were the sauce monster, as Pete has referenced almost constantly since he read this book, is very fun. And as someone who's currently in Missouri, I look forward to somehow fighting my own sauce monster.
It reminds me of when a band goes to a certain place and they kind of reference certain things to be like, hey,
yeah, but they don't. That's a fake thing. That's a thing they look literally. I think it's a Simpsons joke where they're like, all right, hello, looks at back of the guitar. Yeah. Springfield.
Yeah. We love you, Springfield. Yeah. Yeah. But that's the fun bit of the joke of having Godzilla in your town where it's like, oh my God, he's going to wreck my favorite barbecue place. And oh, look at it's a city of fountains. You know, I loved all that
but
stuff.
I don't know. This read more like Godzilla versus Akron as opposed to Godzilla versus a city I'm invested in. Shit happening.
I don't know. Shots fired at Kansas City, I guess.
I don't know. Yeah.
Why don't we?
Guess it should have been Missouri. That would have made you happier.
No, or a city that The references in here are so specific to the city, and also, like, fuck the Chiefs. Let's get the Bills.
Dude, oh, wow, that's what this really is about.
Bills Chiefs this weekend.
Buffalo
Let's go.
Was showing, bro. Let's go. If this Let's was go. Godzilla versus Syracuse, you would have been like, oh, fuck, come on.
Yeah, salt potato monster.
Yeah, you would have loved all of it.
Black Cat, number three for Marvel, written by G. Willow Wilson, art by Gleb Melnikov. Black Cat is trying to go on the straight and narrow and be kind of a hero in this issue that gets more complicated as it goes. Why are you showing your garage beer?
I'm trying to fuck with Just a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Cheers.
I don't have a garage beer, but I do garage. Read Black Cat. Is that what you're trying to say?
No.
Justin, I'm curious to hear from you. My main thought while reading this is... we all really like G. Willow Wilson, Love and Poison Ivy. You're a huge Black Cat fan, but you've been pretty mixed about this title so far. Why is that, and do you feel like this issue is an improvement?
Well, I like the action that's happening. It's interesting. The interior monologue of Black Cat is cool, and her sort of being like, it's weird that I'm a hero, but I'm actually trying this. I like that idea. The thing is, the art just isn't capturing who Black Cat is. The cover that we're looking at right here on the YouTube is, but the interior art, it just feels like a different character, and that makes a lot of the dialogue where she is actually behaving very differently feel like this book is about another character that happens to also be called the Black Cat. So it just feels a little off to me. I'm still enjoying it. There's just a little itch in the back of my head the whole time I'm reading it where it's like, this isn't the same character that I know and love.
Huh. Pete, what about you?
Yeah, I thought this was fun. I mean, I loved the kind of last panel reveal. I thought it was a great use of Sandman. I didn't buy that the J. Jonah Jameson would be such a talker on the phone. But other than that, I thought this is a fun kind of Black Cat issue.
I think I'm kind of on the same page as you, Justin, in terms of the Gleb Melnikov art isn't quite working for me. And I think, you know, you don't need to have, like, overly sexualized Black Cat or anything like that. But
that's not the issue with me at all.
Yeah, it's just, but there's to something, me, like, off about the proportions like of the characters. Yeah. The action scenes, I do think, are well-staged, but... it's more about the sedentary scenes where people are talking that feel a little, like, weirdly stretched and off. I don't know. All right, well, why don't we talk about Radiant Black, number 38 from Image Comics, written by Kyle Higgins and Joe Clark, art by Marcelo Costa. This is a big issue as we get even more new characters introduced, specifically, like, he's not this yet, but evil Radiant Black gets introduced, who works for the government and is supposed to replace Radiant Black alongside a team of other characters with powers who are backing him up. I just love the big moves this title has been taking since they passed the Catalyst War. I think, like, every issue has hit harder and harder as they're making life more and more difficult for Radiant Black.
Yeah, I agree with you. Oh, I like the big moves, but I think even more so, I like the small moves. Mm. The little scenes in between, I think, are really well done.
Talking about the romance?
There's some romance here.
Talking about the romance?
There's a moment where the girl he's on a date with takes her shirt off, and he's like, whoa, those tats. And, like, I just – there's such a real moment, and, like – they do a good job of making them pop in the midst of all this big action and heavy plot drop. There's all these little moments of these characters just behaving like real people. And that, I think, is the secret sauce that makes this book work.
Yeah, this is hard because this continues to be amazing. So how do you keep talking about it? But it is really impressive. I love the romance stuff we got in this. I mean, smooch it up. You know what I mean?
Smooch.
Lord Vader here is really interesting. I just this just continues to be impressive comics. And I agree with JT Sizzle. Like, not only are the big things great, but the small things are also amazing. So
So, and Pete, if you like this, you should check out this genre called romantic comedies, where like these characters sometimes like they come together.
I don't want to yell in the audience's ears again.
It's really interesting you guys like this because you trust her, this new girlfriend. I don't.
I'm not saying I trust her completely, but I like the moments.
Yes.
I think it's
The romance is great. I think she 100% is going to turn out to be evil or villain.
Why? Because she has tattoos, Alex? How
dare
you?
Yeah, and I don't trust people with tattoos.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Well, I will say her explanation, she's like, here's the thing about butterflies, is they fly and they die. And I'm like, oh, okay, that part's
more everything that she's saying, all in her dialogue is like weirdly dark to the point that she'd be like, yeah, and I like killing people. I don't know. There's a turn coming with her, but I agree with you.
And also in the last couple issues, after every date, she's sort of like, you know what? I think we're really connecting. I'm like, that's a weird thing to say on a date. It makes me feel like you're really pushing for that because someone is making you do that.
We shall see. But that's a good romantic trope in and of itself. You should check out that one too, Pete. Synthetics, Volume 1, Number 1 from Dark Horse Comics, written by J. Michael Straczynski, art by Tony Parker. This is a brand new entertainment IP launched by Straczynski that takes place in a future world where there are synthetics, people who are created out of machines. And there is a lot of stuff going on in this issue.
Yeah, is.
You can tell there's a lot because it has the word volume right in the name.
Yep.
You know, the volume is turned up all the way to one, you know?
Not 11, just one.
No, it's just one.
What'd you guys think about this?
Well, I think that, like, the tough thing for me is there's a lot. But also, like,
well, we finally found the ass end of the stack for Pete. Yeah. He talked about this big love for the stack. Yeah. He found the one.
Yeah. I also thought that, like, bees don't make good spies because they make so much noise. You know what I mean? Like, they're not good for spying on people and getting conversations. But I do think the art is really impressive. It has this kind of cool, tripped out sci-fi futuristic thing that I think they pull off really well. But yeah, there's just so much going on that I need another issue. But you know, and they also do like the Matrix, like people in tubes, you know, shit with the pink ooze and all that. But I don't know.
People get in tubes.
Yeah,
people get in tubes all the time.
Yeah, tube it up. You know what I mean? Human batteries, baby. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I mean,
I'm so sorry. Did you just say what hot beans?
Nope.
No. He said what happens.
What happens.
And after he said a lot of other random stuff. It's funny you picked out the end because there's a series of nonsense.
It sounded like wet hot beans to me personally. But.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite type of beans are both wet and hot. Mm-hmm. They're called baked, and my grandma made them, except for not the grandma who I crossed by not sending her a thank you note. The other grandma.
Wow, okay. Cool. Yeah, a lot of
how's she How's she doing?
Well, they're all dead now, but they refused. Jesus. We got along way better. We got along all right up to the end.
Just sit down with grandma over a nice plate of beans.
The grandma that I crossed with the thank you note thing, when my wife and I got married, her wedding gift was a deviled egg platter that was used to the point where it still had old deviled egg mayonnaise in it.
I loved how much she hated
message
you.
Received, grandma.
Yeah.
Message received.
That's wow.
We treasure it to this day. Deviled eggs, a food, one of the only foods I dislike.
Oh, really?
Hey, but same!
I love
it. It's crazy. It's crazy because it's right over the plate for me. I love mayonnaise. But there's something about it I just can't get on
really
board
good.
With. Hard-boiled eggs. I can't. Hard-boiled eggs can't get on board with it.
Normally I can't, but there's enough mayonnaise and, like, cream in there. Gets past it.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I love potato salad with mayonnaise and egg in it, but
have you ever had the deviled eggs at Dinosaur Barbecue?
Oh, yeah.
No. Oh. The one in Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn. I mean, it comes from Buffalo, but yeah. They're in Brooklyn.
No, it comes from Syracuse.
Oh, is it Syracuse? I thought it was Syracuse. Buffalo.
Yes. Okay. Get the fuck off.
I'm so sorry.
Anyway, I pray Godzilla shows up at Dinosaur Barbecue.
The deviled eggs at Dinosaur Barbecue are the best. They are incredible. Check them out.
Yeah.
Wow.
I will do
my
that.
My top pick on the stack is the deviled eggs from Dinosaur Barbecue in Syracuse.
Getting back to Syracuse, thank you. Getting back to Pete's favorite book, Synthetics, Volume 1. it is a little ram-jammed with a lot of sci-fi tropes.
I'm just imagining J. Michael Straczynski being like, oh, somebody reviewed my new book. Let me listen to this.
He's going to love this series of takes. He's going to be probably taking notes on where to visit.
He's a hell of a writer, man. I don't think he has anything to worry about.
No, great writer. I do think it, honestly, though, like, I didn't dislike this book. It's just, it's top heavy.
It's a lot in
Yeah, it's top heavy with, like, sci-fi ideas, but then it sort of evens out to get to a place where I'm like, oh, I am on board with these, with what's happening a bit here.
Yeah, but agreed.
It's just a, you know, you're jumping into the pool as opposed to dipping a toe in. Yeah.
Yeah. And we are dipping our toes out because that's it for the stack. If you'd like to support this podcast, I was about to say book, podcast and all the podcasts we do.
Support our book.
This should be a book.
Yeah.
This should be a book.
This should be an email.
Patreon.com/comicbookclub to support this show and all the shows we do. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Yeah. Come for us, Godzilla. Bring it to Syracuse. We will wreck you, dude. We will wreck you.